cjsffunddrive.ca or text donate to 778-782-2573 and help us rise higher and reach further.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, after the closure of three news outlets in April, a local news co-op has now launched for Burnaby, New Westminster, and the Tri-City area. Danny Nesrandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. And in the north, the BCGEU has reached a tentative agreement, and a vote by its members is expected on November 6th. Pam Hassan at CACK News in Smithers has that story. I'm Daniel Messick. You're listening to The Scoop.
This is Danny Nesvetterani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In late April of this year, Lodestar Media, formerly known as Glacier Media, closed down three of its news publications, The Burnaby Now, The New Westminster Record, and The Tri-City News. The main reason given for the closures were budget constraints. But these closures also drastically decreased the level of local news available in the municipalities of Burnaby, New Westminster, Port Coquitlam, Coquitlam, and Port Moody. In June of this year, four journalists who previously worked with the closed Lodestar Media publications banded together to start the Save Our Local News campaign. The campaign was created in collaboration with Media Workers Union Unifor, and after raising $55,000, a new publication, founded by veteran local journalists Mario Battelle, Janice Clue, Cornelia Naylor, and Teresa McManus, has finally launched. The publication is named Freshet News, and it serves to provide local news coverage to the communities of New Westminster, Burnaby, and the Tri-Cities. To learn more about Freshet News, what the plans are for this publication, and how they want to set themselves apart as a nonprofit newsroom, we sat down for a conversation with Cornelia Naylor, a longtime local journalist and co-founder of Freshet News. You know, this is a bit of a long time coming. I know that the Save Our Local News campaign was kind of going on all throughout the summer and resulted due to the closures of three Glacier Media, well now Lodestar publications, the Burnaby Now, the New Westminster Record, and Tri-City News. Could you give a bit of a timeline of, you know, the layoffs happening, those publications closing, to you sort of banding together with these other journalists that were also part of the same publications and creating Freshet News?
First, I'm so impressed that you've been following this whole thing for as long as it's been going on. I mean, the timeline's been pretty short when you consider what we're trying to do, but yeah, it does feel like a big accomplishment to have launched our website last week. Okay, so timeline. I guess we would say that it starts back in 2023 when Glacier Media, now Lodestar, decided to close our print publications. And then after a year, I guess it's a couple of years after that, they shut us down completely, saying that for financial reasons, they said. And we think one of those financial reasons is that they left money on the table when they closed the print product. That's why we think that part is significant. So we found out in February that they were going to close us down, and the Burnaby Now shut down. Well, I guess we both did at the end of the Burnaby Now and New Westminster Record, and then the Tri-City News. We were on different collective agreements, so our closure agreements were slightly different, but I think we all shut our doors at the end of April.
At what point after the closure did you decide to band together with some of the other journalists that were part of those publications?
Well, we kind of just were upset or reconciled to just kind of going our different ways, I think, and looking for other jobs, that kind of thing. But we were approached, we were thrown a lifeline by a co-op developer who approached us, various social medias and emails that he tried, and eventually we met with that organization, the Union Cooperative Initiative, and they said that they thought this would be an excellent idea or an excellent opportunity to create a co-op model to save local news in these three communities. And so that started shortly after the closures were announced, and then we didn't really start working on it in earnest until we were closed altogether with that organization.
I know throughout the summer you were out and about in the community, different events. What was the engagement process like? You know, what were some of the things you were hearing from people regarding, you know, the pretty distinct lack of local news that was occurring at the time?
Yeah, I would say our first few community events happened after a few weeks, maybe even a month after we shut down entirely. Our websites were gone. There was no more local news flowing. And people were really upset and really happy about the idea of us coming back. What we kept hearing over and over again is that people did not know what was going on in their communities. They didn't, just basic events, which kind of surprised me. I always thought that was kind of just a add-on in our news coverage and stuff, is just events listings, but people wanted that. Even though you can Google that stuff, I guess they wanted it in one place for their community. So that was one thing they missed. And the other thing was City Hall coverage, which I thought was really interesting too, because that at least is one of those things that doesn't really get a lot of clicks online, and it was something that was kind of not exactly that coverage wasn't exactly supported and encouraged from our corporate owner. Mm-hmm. Because it didn't generate a lot of clicks online.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ties into another question I had, which was just how is Fresha, you know, as a news cooperative going to differ from the previous publications that you worked for? You know, is there going to be sort of a difference in the kind of stories you tell or the ways that you're telling it? You know, it's less profit-driven. So in this case, do you have the time to sort of focus on the more niche, hyper-local that may not get as many clicks?
Yeah. When I first started 15 years ago in local news, we were writing good, solid, sort of bread-and-butter local coverage, school board, city hall, the courts, lots of local news features and events, that kind of thing. And it's not that corporate media in the past with their local news outlets hasn't done that. They have done that. It's why people love and appreciate local news, even though they might have taken it for granted over these years. So I'd like us to go back to that kind of careful, you know, on the ground news coverage. And that's kind of what we expect to do, just basic, good local news coverage. The difference, I think, is that had been eroded by the time our newspapers closed. By that time, I was getting a little existentially angsty, and I think maybe my colleagues were too, about just becoming content creators. You know, it's just whatever bakery opening, not that bakery openings are not important, but just real clickbaity stuff that we were expected to just churn out, and lots of it. And I think with four journalists at the helm, because we are the ones making the decisions in this co-op, I think we're going to go back to, you know, we have to sort of slow ourselves down, get off the hamster wheel, and start doing that solid local news coverage again.
Mm-hmm.
And we're excited about that.
Yeah, and I mean, this has proven successful in other places. I remember the Save Our Local News campaign citing a similar thing happening in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And it and proving to be successful. I guess, how did that come about?
Well, yeah, that is kind of a model that we've looked for, at least a success story. So in Quebec, there were six daily newspapers, very much local news, but they were dailies. We were just free weekly papers. And they were going to all close because the corporate owner had the same sort of financial difficulties, I guess, that they ran into. So they were going to shut down six communities' news outlets. And the Quebec government, there was a big hue and cry. Politicians even got on board, I believe. But then the Quebec government stepped in with a $5 million, I think it was an interest-free loan or something like that, and they created a co-op, the same kind of co-op that we're looking at, a union cooperative, or where the members are union members as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going. Yeah, it's going now. That the shift to a co-op model saved those six papers. Our funding model, what we envision is that it will be advertising. We're looking at some sort of memberships, but we're still deciding what that means, membership or subscription. We don't expect that we will be putting up a paywall or that our paper will be something that you pay for, but maybe delivery to your home, like your front step, might be something that you pay for. Or certain content, certain parts of the content online might be things that we monetize. We're doing fundraising. We're right in the middle of another fundraising campaign. Our first fundraising campaign raised $55,000. So that's going to be important for us to continue campaigning and fundraising, basically. Since launching, we've also launched another fundraiser. And those are people really excited about local news actually flowing. And that was so encouraging for us. That and we're looking at grants. We're looking at everything we can.
Mm-hmm. When can we expect the physical newspaper, if there's any news on that?
Oh, right. We haven't even talked about that. Yeah. Well, our stretch goal is to have a print product. Right from the get-go, what we talked about was we think that people in the communities want print. We've talked to people in the ad industry, an ad agency, former ad sales people, and when they heard from their clients, their advertisers, they said the company expected them to move over to digital advertising, and they didn't. Those advertisers just dropped off. So we think that there are a lot of people out there, especially in the community, that want people in their own community, they're the people that are going to come to their stores that they can advertise in print. Those are the people that are targeted with the paper. So, if we can manage to get enough support, if we can manage to monetize the website like the way that we need to, then hopefully our goal is to launch in the spring, to get a print publication out in the spring.
So the last couple questions I wanted to ask were, I guess, more personal ones, looking into the backgrounds of all the journalists involved within Fresh Air News. You're someone who's been involved within local journalism for quite a long time, 15 years or so?
And I'm the one who's been in local journalism the shortest time. Between us, we have like 100 years of local news coverage experience. One of my colleagues is, I think both, two of them have 30 years of experience in local news. So
yeah.
Actually, I think all of them do, now that I think about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, like what keeps you here?
It's an excellent question. It is such a fun job. The variety of it. I mean, as a local journalist, you cover everything. I love animal stories. They're always so weird and quirky. You get to sit down and talk to people in your community, and life is both stranger and more beautiful than fiction when you talk to certain people in the community and you can really get into those stories. You know that the coverage that you're doing of civic institutions like City Hall or the school board or the courts really matters because nobody else is doing that coverage. They swoop in if a story is really interesting, and in the past that's how the bigger outlets have gotten some of their scoops and their stories, is that they follow up on local news reporting, and that's a thing that's eroding and is really important. But on a personal level, I just love it. I love being in the courts. I love the people you get to meet, the dedication to craft, the storytelling itself, the variety. It's never done. You can never do it well enough, but it's always a great challenge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The publications closing earlier in April, do you feel like you were always like acutely aware of the importance of local news, or was it something that like really put it into perspective for you once it was gone, essentially?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when you ask me personally, I've always loved this job. It wasn't like it's you don't know what you got till it's gone, in terms of my own personal enjoyment of the job. But since the papers closed and we've looked into why people are concerned about local news disappearing, and even the fact that it's disappearing at an alarming rate across Canada and North America and possibly the world, but definitely in Canada, has made us more aware of its importance societally. There were a couple of reports written earlier this year, or that came out earlier this year, that really underlined that. One of them said that when communities, it's data coming out of the states, that when communities lose their local newspaper, they tend to retreat into more partisan corners. And we've definitely seen that in the states and in Canada more and more. When you lose your local newspaper, people go online and they retreat into their, you know, their ideological corners and just throw rocks at each other. And there's nothing that they can share, like, you know, like a community news feature that can, at least they're in the same reality, you know, and fact checking, and people that are dedicated, you know, professionals in terms of making sure that the facts that they put out can be trusted and that we've done the best we can to verify the things that we're saying. Those things are important so that people don't retreat and become more divided. And that to me is a really important concern in democracy today. The other thing was the idea, the other report said that local news is like the bedrock of good journalism, a good journalism ecosystem, and therefore really important for democracy in for that same reason that I was talking about earlier, that we are on the ground in those communities covering things that other people don't. Those institutions that really affect people, like the bylaws and the decisions coming out of City Hall, what happens in their local schools, what happens, what their police force is doing, what their fire department's doing. We're there giving people the information they need to make informed decisions as informed citizens. And that's just key to democracy. Those are all things, to answer your question, those are all things that have become more and more front of mind for us, or even just, we've just realized them more, you know? Mm-hmm. We didn't realize how important we were. It's crazy to me that now you have a website, our website, and there would have been nothing had we not, you know, established it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to
even
your point. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, I mean, even the Burnaby Beacon recently, I think I had a merger with the Georgia Strait.
That's right.
Like, it seems like a lot of it is either being dealt with in mergers or just straight-up closures,
mm-hmm.
In that sense. Those were the questions I wanted to ask, but I guess the last thing I'd want to ask of you is if there's just any other information regarding Freshet News and the work that all of you are doing that you would like our listeners to know about.
Well, they can sign up for our newsletter. They can visit our website, freshetnews.ca. And what we really want to do with this publication, to answer part of another question that you asked earlier, how do we want to be different? We want to be more engaged in the community. We want to hear more from our readers. We want to be able to have community events or events where readers can come and meet us and we can talk about stuff and different ideas for engagement. We haven't quite nailed all of those down yet, but we do want to hear from you. We want to hear letters. We want news tips. Sign up, subscribe, visit us.
Sounds good. I mean, and for those of you listening, CJSF would also love news tips as well. So if you can send those over to both Freshet News and CJSF.ca, please do. All right. Thank you so much, Cornelia.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Once again, that was our interview with Cornelia Naylor, a local journalist, reporter, and co-founder of the newly launched publication Freshet News, which aims to provide coverage for the areas of Burnaby, New Westminster, and the Tri-Cities. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, I check in with a worker from the BCGEU about the end of the strike. Under the new agreement, BCGEU members will see a general wage increase of 3% over 4 years, with extra pay adjustments for the lowest paid workers to help address the affordability crisis. The deal also modernizes work conditions, improving fairness around telework, strengthening job protections, and speeding up the grievance process. It adds better vision care and counseling benefits to support mental health as well, and formally recognizes fully remote workers with the new protections tailored to their roles.
Hi, my name is Ryan LaPointe, and I'm a public servant working for the BC Public Service.
Okay, so we're speaking on Tuesday, October 28th. And you were just filling me in before we were recording how fast this decision was to go back to work. So I guess, yeah, can you just walk me through, yeah, just how that's feeling, where we are to date?
Yeah, the union and the government have been locked, sort of deadlocked for quite a long time. And both parties agreed to mediation a little over a week ago, and very suddenly over the weekend, the last details were decided on, and a tentative agreement was reached on Sunday.
Yeah, and the union says that this deal, it's making real progress on wages and respect for frontline workers. But from your perspective, does it feel like this is a fair outcome for what you went through?
It's tricky. I think for a lot of people, this was a sort of compromise position we were expecting or hoping to get to without going on strike for a couple months. So there's definitely a little bit of bitterness that it took us this long to get here. Ultimately, in terms of fairness, you know what, it's a very modest increase. So it's a step forward, a baby step forward. And I think for people, we're happy to be back at work and have that in our hands.
Do you feel like it was worth going through the harder parts and sacrifices that you had to make being on strike?
It's hard, and everyone came into the strike in a different position. It definitely was emotionally hard for a lot of people. A lot of people felt betrayed. Some people, you know, worked quite hard in their private lives to support what happened. And being out of work for unpaid leave for 2 months for some people, it's quite a long time. It's obviously very difficult. People have mortgages, they have rent, they've got dinner. And I think it was worth it, and I think most people will think it is worth it because I think labor, we're starting to realize we have to fight for our fair share with the growth in inequality. It doesn't matter an individual's politics. Most people have fallen behind significantly in the last few decades. And so if nothing else, we're learning that we have our voice and we have to use it.
You said betrayed. Who?
I think that a number of employees definitely get told, as many employers do, that they greatly value their employees and they have a bottom line, of course. You want to get what you pay for and you don't want unhappy workers. At the same time, I think lots of people, the public service is made up of people from all political parties and all political backgrounds. And a lot of people feel like it doesn't matter what political party you're from. They feel like the politicians maybe haven't been listening to workers.
Okay. And now that the agreement is headed to ratification, what are you hoping to see in the details before you cast your vote?
Yeah, so there's been a few areas where it's not entirely clear if where compromises were made or to what extent. I think for others, one thing that's important for us is some of the non-financial matters. And so an example of this, the union has been requiring or demanding that the government has a higher percentage of managers in recent years, and that's a growing concern. I think it's a concern for many workers. I also think it might be a concern for many taxpayers. We, as in public servants, we care a lot about efficiency and government delivering to the public a lot. And I think a lot of people are concerned that, well, there's too much management sometimes and not enough action at that sort of that level of the people doing the stuff. Of course, management is important, and we've got lots of good relationships with managers. But we're worried that there might be a top-heavy organization, and that makes it more difficult for workers to get their work done. It weakens unions, and ultimately, it doesn't necessarily provide a better service for the public.
Mm-hmm. Now, when agreements are brought to, it feels like that's the end, but what do you think are the next steps for yourself as a government employee?
For us, we're going to be going through education. We're going to be talking about the different details of the agreement. And honestly, I think between myself and many other workers, we're going to be talking about this. And one thing that is interesting for me personally is I'm seeing more people talking about their experience with this and just generally how we as a society and as whether it's labor unions, employers, governments, how we actually work and with the cost of living crisis in particular, how we're sharing the benefits we have in society. And that is the big step that I think is going to go forward beyond the ratification process, whether it's a yes or a no.
Excellent. Ryan, was there anything I didn't ask that you think is important for people to know?
One thing I think it's important to know is that, like, public servants, by and large, are very eager people. They like doing what they do. We generally really like serving the public. It sounds nerdy, it might sound fake, but I guarantee you it is true. And a lot of people were a bit whiplashed at suddenly being out of work and then back at work. We're happy to be working. We're not necessarily always happy about the terms of that work, but we are happy to do that. And we hope that the connections that people have made, whether it's through taking up additional jobs whether it was businesses support or local community members that supported us, that we keep these relationships going and ultimately build a stronger community here in Smithers and in other communities as well going forward.
Okay, thank you so much for reaching out and for sharing this update.
All right, thank you, Pam.
Under the agreement, employees will receive a general wage increase of 3% over 4 years, and the vote will likely happen on November 6th. The BCGEU Bargaining Committee will recommend the agreement for ratification. BCGEU members will continue to respect Professional Employment Association picket lines in solidarity with the striking members. Details of the agreement will be released following the completion of the ratification process. Thanks once again to Ryan LaPointe for being my contact throughout this process. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. It's Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
This is Bird Note. Think a moment. What is your state bird? All 50 states and the District of Columbia declare official birds. Most were chosen many decades back. To run as top candidate for state bird in those days, it helped to be familiar, boldly colorful, and have a punchy song. The defiantly red, sweetly singing northern cardinal perches as state bird in 7 eastern states. The sunny yellow western meadowlark sings its liquid phrases for 6 western states. Bluebirds and goldfinches flashed primary colors for another 7, and the northern mockingbird, the country's most insistent songster, holds down 5 states. So it is the exceptions to the loud and colorful that stand out. New Mexico elected the Greater Roadrunner, a quirky emblem of the Southwest. But the most ironic choice comes from the District of Columbia, the most raucous and unsubtle venue of all. They chose the wood thrush, a shy bird of forest shadows with a voice approaching high art. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Is community-supported radio. That means no ads, no corporate playlists, just real voices and stories brought to you by volunteers. Fund Drive is the one time each year we ask for your support. If you believe in diverse, independent media, now's the time to show it. Help us rise higher and reach further by donating at cjsffunddrive.ca or text the word DONATE to 778-782-2573 to get the donation link.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 288. Thanks for tuning in. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Nalini Mohabir, who is a writer, educator, and the co-author of The Fire That Time. Nalini teaches at Concordia University in Montreal, and I have gotten to know about Nalini's work over the last years. And this particular project, The Fire That Time, I think is really important to talk about right now. It is a book that looks into the anti-racist movements of students at Concordia University, then the Sir George Williams, where Black students and their allies rose up against systemic racism at Concordia University in the late 1960s. That led to a series of demonstrations and actions, and what would become known in Quebec, Montreal, and in Canada as the Sir George Williams Affair. Outside of short news reports, The Fire That Time is a book that I think delves deeply